CEOs Speak is an exclusive Bitbeam podcast series featuring interviews of hundreds of skilled and talented CEOs who share their strategies for leading some of the country's most successful companies. Join Charlie Katz, our executive extraordinaire, as he uncovers the heart and soul of today's business leaders.
This morning, we're very fortunate to have the Hunter brothers, Colin and Wint. And if I have it correctly, Colin is the older brother and Wint is the younger brother. Am I correct?
That's absolutely correct. Colin, I clarified this before you got on.
And they're the founders of Better World, which is a crowdsourcing platform online for individuals and for NPOs. Welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm always curious when you talk about a business, where it started from. And I always feel that it really starts early on. Before college, even before your teens, when you're youngsters, and there was something that inspired you in a direction, something that motivated you to go in a certain direction. Both of you have tech degrees, as I understand, and yet you went in entrepreneurial. So when you were youngsters in elementary school, did you have lemonade stands? What was it in your blood that turned you into entrepreneurs?
I think for us, it was really kind of ran in the family, but in different ways. Our grandfather, on our father's side was kind of a lifelong entrepreneur. He helped start DuPont Asia and kind of moved over there and worked for DuPont for most of his life. And then on our grandfather on our mother's side, he left his job as a trader on Wall Street to go mining for gold, out in Colorado. And then our father is an entrepreneur. He's built a think tank, in the academic space. So growing up, it was very much, you can do anything and look at the world in a different way and see the things that either you're passionate about or the things that bother you, and go in and try to make it better and try to make the world better. And I think for us, that was very much the ethos around the dinner tables, conversations about what do you want to see different and kind of being the change that you hope to see in the world.
You know, my background in marketing is a writer, and I was writing in my elementary years. So, and I come from a family of some wrote novels, some wrote a journalist. And I remember when I was very young that an uncle of mine who had been in World War II, actually, but then he was much older, but he had worked for the Army newspaper. And it was sounded very exciting and stimulating to me, not just the writing, but traveling around and, you know, as a writer. And I look back now and I say to myself, okay, I was surrounded by writers, so to speak. But at the same time, I started writing even before I was fully aware I was younger than that. So the question I want to pose is almost like a universal question. Is the entrepreneurial spirit essentially part of your DNA? In other words, is it sufficient the fact that you have entrepreneurs around you to motivate you, inspire you, or does it have to be something inherently within you that maybe was passed down, but it's almost biological in order for it to really take seed and take root?
Yeah, I wonder. I hear the stories of the entrepreneurs that were selling gum in middle school and then T-shirts in high school and then had their fifth business by the time they were 15. And I've always been envious of that. I spent my youth growing up playing competitive tennis, and that's essentially all I did. I only got my first taste of the startup world when I was 18. I left high school. I worked in a startup over in China. And then the rest is history. I couldn't get enough of it after that. So I don't know. I mean, as far as the nature and nurture, side of the question, I imagine our father does a lot of work. He's a sociologist that studies families and upbringing and culture. So I imagine he would say it's a lot more of culture, of the subtext of the dinner table, the conversations that flow through the house. But I don't know.
Well, and in many parts of the world, entrepreneurship is really about necessity. And I've spent time living in Africa and Asia, and in a lot of communities, you just figure out a way to make a living and to provide for your family and to put food on the table.
Okay. Interesting question. Both of you, as I understand, have spent time overseas. Do you miss that? Do you miss the expat world and exoticness and discovering something different versus the familiarity of America? Did you have an inner desire to go back and establish yourself overseas?
I think for me, travel will always be a big part of my life. I love Virginia. I love where we live. But there's something about being able to go experience other cultures, whether that's for, you know, 2 weeks, 2 months, or 2 years, that can be incredibly valuable. So I think I'm certainly open to living overseas. I certainly miss travel over the course of this pandemic, not being able to leave the country and see more of the world. But I would imagine that experiencing cultures will always be a part of my life, regardless of where I'm living.
For both of you, have you found that the period of time you lived overseas affected you in some way in how you look at things, even here in your business? Have you taken things with you that you look at things differently than particularly if you had not gone overseas?
Yeah, and Colin and I probably have very different experiences on this. My first time at any length overseas was, again, 18 years old, having grown up living a very sheltered life, playing tennis, knowing the small town of Charlottesville, Virginia, as the extent of my worldview, to some degree. So going and living in Delhi, living in Shanghai, living in Bangkok for a month on end, probably each location. I actually lived in Shanghai for a year. Completely changed the way that I saw business, the way that I saw the need to do good, as far as experiencing poverty, experiencing pain in ways that I had never seen before. Definitely lit a spark.
Colin, anything from your end?
I think very, very similarly. It's interesting. Similar to Whit, I've lived in multiple different places, and I spent a year living in South Africa. And this is 20 years post apartheid. It was basically a brand new economy. And so you see things from an entrepreneurial angle. I would see businesses that existed in the U.S. that just hadn't come to South Africa yet. And so you can certainly see opportunity. But yeah, I think a similar vein with Whit is just that was probably an early spark for us for a better world is just how evident the need is in a lot of these countries. And seeing that a relatively small amount of dollars, if used efficiently through a network of partners, can actually do a lot of good. And we've seen that in various places. And that is kind of has led to some of our various entrepreneurial endeavors, but certainly trying to empower a network of organizations that are trying to do good on the ground and making it easier for them to do that.
So let's go now on to a better world. It seems to have been a mutual thinking process on both your parts. Did you sort of sit around the table one day and say, we saw this poverty, we saw this need, what can we do about it? How did the idea for a better world come about?
I think it was much, it was, I wish that we had thought of where we are now 8 years ago as part of a master plan. It was much more random. It was much more, sort of happenstance. So, when I was an undergrad at the University of Virginia, I came across, I was trying to raise funds for, the main building on our campus called the Rotunda. It was designed by Jefferson, by Thomas Jefferson, and it was in need of repair. I came across this old collection of university antiques that were dating back hundreds of years, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we put those online so that the university and community could bid on them? And more than just antiques, what if we also looked at if we could raise more money through offering, reaching out to the tennis team and seeing if they'd offer a lesson, reaching out to a marketing professor and seeing if they would, you know, sit down with somebody for an hour as an item. So we created that from scratch, sort of as one of a number of probably 10 different ideas that I built, with my friend in college. And that was the impetus of the first online auction that we created, which then expanded to donations, to ticketing, to crowdfunding, to this broader vision of the company that Colin and I are both interested in, which helps nonprofits, which helps individuals to contribute to nonprofits in creative ways, and helps businesses to get back in creative ways, that actually contribute to their bottom line.
I'm just going to throw out a thought. And when you talk about the antiques, as an alternative to selling them, had you made them copies, and sold the copies? There's years ago in my, I came across an intriguing idea that somebody had done with Mattel, and he simply bought the rights to their retro trucks, like retro milk truck, trucks and retro bakeries and fire engines. And he would get the licensing from the university just simply to put the university name on it. Hmm. And it would sell like wildfire because alumni want to be, always have some tangible thing, you know, like all the things that they buy to say, you know, that's on the desk or in their room or something that reminds them. And the antiques sounded really interesting as a model for doing that. For whatever this idea is worth, it was just probably nothing. So you went off and now, a business, you identify that a lot of the money or a good portion of the money that is raised does not go to the end user or the end recipient. And I assume a lot of that has to do with marketing expenses and if you use an outside service, the fee that they take. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, the default in the charitable gift industry. You know, it's probably first just important to understand the environment in which fundraising happens. A lot of nonprofits we've found, and we've been a part of, we've started nonprofits, we've been donors, we've been on boards, we've helped with auction committees and things. We've seen it from every angle. And there are a few common commonalities. First, no one ever has enough time. You never have enough time and money. And so there were solutions out there that we saw that were good, but very expensive. And so priced out a lot of smaller initiatives or smaller nonprofits. Or there were other solutions out there that were just complex and difficult to use. Or you had to use about 8 different tools to get to accomplish everything that you needed. And we felt like there was an opportunity to, if we could disrupt the charitable giving space by making it easier and by making it free, now you're saving people time and money. And so to answer your question, the status quo is platform fees that people take, large kind of monthly fees to sign up and use various tools. They'll take a percentage of transactions. And when you're talking about, you know, $430 billion plus given to charity every year in the U.S., even 10 to 15% that might be taken as a percentage of transactions or platform fees or anything from individual giving, that adds up very quickly. And we felt that there's an opportunity for what if more of those dollars could actually go to these organizations and go to the end causes that they are supporting and they're working on, that would be a real, that would be really exciting. What would be the impact of an additional $20 to $30 billion out there doing good? And that was, you know, taking that origin story that Whit talked through of the very first auction, we started to look at just the broader world of charitable fundraising and trying to understand how can we make it better and how do we save a lot of the money that's actually going to companies that are profiting from nonprofits trying to raise money to do their good work.
Business model? How do you cover your costs and salaries and so on? The retreat.
Yeah. So one of the secrets to platform technology is that once you built it, it's actually not the cost to running it is a lot less than the cost to build it. So we've spent 7 years building this platform, which allows us to, and we have a small agile team. It allows us to make a lot less because we've already built these really good tools that are self-service. There are two ways that our platform can be supported, though. The primary way is through donors adding on an optional contribution to Better World when they're making a donation or making a purchase. It's totally optional, but enough donors do it that we feel we have a sustainable business and we're able to fund growth. The other option that we have that we're able to support our platform is consulting, onboarding for organizations that could use a little bit of extra help and handholding. We're able to do that with a personal touch and to be helpful there.
So, Khaled, you have a men's line, I understand. Alton Lane, if I pronounce it correctly. Is that, which is your full-time or which business are you mostly devoted to?
Oh, Better World. So Alton Lane was a company that I co-founded, 11 years ago, coming up on 12 years ago, and spent the better part of a decade growing it and scaling it across the country, and got it to a place where we had a fantastic team, and I was ready to move on and work on some new ventures. And so was able to now shift a lot of my focus over to Better World.
So talking from a marketing standpoint, you entered a field and there was with crowdsourcing online with a vulnerability or an opportunity based on, as I understand, the complexity of working with the other crowdsourcing platforms, as also the end dollar that the individual or the non-profit would receive, and you created a better mousetrap, as they say. Typically, when that happens, it tilts in your favor. And one or two things happens when it tilts in your favor. Either the others play catch-up, or they fall by the wayside. What is happening now based on Better World in the overall industry in regards to your, what we call, unique selling proposition and your positioning?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, first off, maybe Colin, you can talk about the latter question. I'll clarify our unique selling proposition. We've been able to differentiate on three main areas. And the root of good marketing that I've learned to understand is empathy. We started to understand the people that were using our platform as nonprofit leaders who might not be the most technical savvy in the world, that are busy, that have 1,000 other things to do. How can we make their life easier? And how can we give that messaging in everything that we do? So that's been key to our growth, is driving home this sort of empathetic marketing of we exist to make your life easier, to help more dollars go to the causes you care about. And as a result, our marketing statistics and growth have been exceptional. Google's accelerated growth team reached out to us. They partnered with us. We've seen over 100% compound monthly growth month over month for the last 10 months. I think over 5,000% since the beginning of the year. We went from maybe 10 new clients a month to now 3,000 to 5,000 organizations a month. So as far as what the industry will do to catch up to better worlds, it kind of remains to be seen. We're certainly making a point, because we're competing and we're going out against everyone with the messaging that this is how fundraising tools should be. They should be beautiful. They should be easy to use. They should be free. We'll see what the response is, but we're excited for it.
Yeah. And I think just adding on to that, you know, Whit and I very much have, core to our ethos at Better World is an abundance mentality. This is, there are many companies out there that are doing really good work to help nonprofits do the work that they do. And we hope for their success as well. This is not a zero sum game. For us, we believe that, we spend 99.9% of our time focused on our own product and talking to our own customers. And how can we, if we can understand them well and build a focus on building the best and most beautiful and easiest products, we hope that that sets a standard in the rest of the industry that others will follow. And I'm sure to your point that there will be others that fall by the wayside. And that usually that happens in a free market. But for us, it's actually, that would be a really positive metric of success if we were able to influence other companies to do better, and to serve more people in a better way.
How do you promote yourself to the donor? How do you promote? How does he aware even? Is it simply that he's coming to you through that individual who reached out to him? So how, in other words, the promotion really starts from the NPO. Do you help them with the promotion in any sense, or that's really in their hands?
Yeah, first off, you're correct that the promotion and the messaging comes from the nonprofit. We try to talk to the people that are leading the nonprofits to get them on board and then equip them with the tools to reach their community. So we actually just released yesterday, as an example of this, guided marketing templates for when an organization is running a campaign. Again, part of the way that we like to make running these campaigns as easy as possible is it's pre-filled templates for you to post on social media, by email, to your board, to volunteers, that gets the message out about the auction, the raffle, the ticketed event that you're doing, to make that outreach to your donors really easy.
There's also a certain amount of virality that happens organically in this space. You know, we have, as we mentioned, we have several thousand nonprofits signing up every month to use our platform. And as they run campaigns, they will have, you know, 50, 100, 200 donors that are participating in their auction or crowdfunding campaign or anything like that. And all of those donors are also typically involved in some other cause or some other nonprofit. And so they'll experience our platform through one of their organizations that they support. And they'll say, hey, this is actually really great. You know who we should use this at my elementary school or my church or synagogue or any of these other organizations that they're a part of. So we do see this network effect that's really encouraging. And again, that's why we try to spend so much time focusing on building the best product and user experience, because if we do that, the word will naturally spread in the way that things are set up.
Do you, in your, you have a section on your website for the businesses and how they participate, the donors, let's say. Are you familiar with the Cohen-Roper report about the advantages of having a cause marketing? Are you familiar with cause marketing? So this goes back to, you know, I'm an agency, Madison Avenue Advertising Agency guy, and I remember years ago I came across a report that just flabbergasted me. It was like, whoa. And it's by Cohen-Roper, C-O-N-E-R-O-P-E-R. And I think and what they said basically is that if your company supports the cause that the consumer believes in, you will either switch to your product or buy from you if you're retail, as long as everything is relatively the same, the quality and the price. But simply the fact that you are supporting a cause that he identifies with. And I don't think you'll find a major corporation in America that is not involved with causes. I write articles on marketing, and I listed across the board, you know, Home Depot, 1,000 playgrounds, Tom's Shoes, of course, very famously giving away free shoes, Patagonia, and so on and so forth. The one I have to say is an aside that totally puzzles me, because every one of them had two things in common. For instance, Walmart is supporting community hospitals. Makes sense. They're all over in communities, are community focused. Everyone had a tie-in. The one that I did not understand, and I left it for the readers to figure it out, I admit it, I do not understand the connection, is the, what do you call it, the Coca-Cola saving the polar bears. I have nothing to do with polar bears, but I just couldn't see Coke and polar bears exactly where the synergy was. But this is a very interesting, and it continues. I mean, it gets stronger into this. The numbers from Con Roper keep getting stronger and stronger. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's a two-sided edge to when a business donates. One, on one hand, they want to do well, but it's reciprocal. The people who see that they're helping support their cause will turn to them. Has that message ever been delivered through the NPOs that, you know, it benefits you in other ways as well, that it creates a loyalty and allegiance, alliance with our supporters?
Yeah, I think it's interesting with us because a lot of our, you know, quote unquote customers are, they're the nonprofits, and we're not selling a product in a typical way, and our product's free. So we really view it as, we are trying to support them. If there was one cause that if we had to sum up kind of our cause, I would probably say, our cause is seeing communities thrive.
Let me clarify. The question I'm asking is the NPO themselves telling their donors the fact that when you donate to us visibly, it benefits you in helping build your business essentially. That's what Con Roper was pointing out. I'll just give an example. I remember that I lived in LA for many years, and this is too many examples, but this one pops into my mind, that American Express read a big double-page spread in LA Times. If you buy a Valley bra today using American Express card, we will donate money to the Breast Cancer Foundation. Now, I can guarantee you nobody's sitting on the board of, what do you call it, of American Express was that concerned about breast cancer. But I can tell you that they're very concerned about getting more women to use American Express. That's what I'm talking about. The idea that by donating, it's also in a sense a marketing tool, a pure marketing tool. And has the NPOs ever used that message, gotten that message across to their supporters as another way to get them to give support or more support?
You've identified one of the most exciting questions that I want to lean into as a business in the coming year. It's this interplay. It's been one of the founding questions of Better World of not just how can we make this beneficial for nonprofits, but how can we make this beneficial for the businesses that are giving to the nonprofits? And in doing so, make it more sustainable for the business, but also look at, instead of the business's small chunk of money that they might give to charitable giving, how can we start to look at the money they're spending on advertising or promotions? And if we can channel that in ways that give back to nonprofits, we can increase the size of the pie of the dollars that are doing good. So it's a really exciting question that we're just starting to explore as a platform. And Colin had an interesting, again, when he was running Alton Lane, he would get asked maybe 300 times a year to give to various charities. And he'd love to do so because, again, they were a mission-driven company as well and wants to support communities. But at some point he says, I need this to be sustainable for me as a business. So we've been building out some tools behind the scenes that we'll release later this year that allows businesses to partner with nonprofits that make sense to partner with, to do good, but actually see a marketing return from the dollars they're giving to charity.
Oh, that is a great goal, and I think it will be very effective. Let's jump to the current circumstances. In the interview, you mentioned, as you mentioned just earlier, the great growth of nonprofits that have jumped aboard. Given COVID, there are so many businesses that have been hurt drastically. Some, unfortunately, quite a number have gone out of business. Have you seen the actual amount of donations decrease significantly because nobody's around to give or because they can't afford to give?
I think we've seen a shift in the style of donations. There are still businesses that are giving and maybe able to give gift cards for the future. We've seen a shift towards personal donations for auctions and giveaways. I have a stay at my downtown apartment that I'll offer for a weekend. I can offer a tennis lesson. I can, the community coming together to offer in-kind, items, as opposed to in-person items at a business. December was the biggest month we've ever seen as far as auctions on our platform. Just the type of item shifted away from, you know, dinner for two at a restaurant to, 30-minute call, consulting call, or outdoor photography shoot.
What Colin said just a moment ago, I experienced firsthand. I freely give my time to advise small businesses, and I do get this question throughout the year. They're coming up. I'm getting so many calls from local charities. Should I give? Shouldn't I give? What should I do? And they would like to give, but as Colin said, you're trying to run a sustainable business, and at some point it works against you. So when you come up with that solution of how to turn it into really have a marketing impact, let me know. For instance, I can never answer them truly. If you give to an auction and your name is there, what is the impact does it have on, and if people go to an auction, there's something exciting that they want to acquire, and they bid and so on and so forth, and they see Most Plumbing as an example is going to give you, free pipe repair for the winter, as an example, just on an idea. Do they remember Most Piping throughout the year and say, because they participate in the auction, we want to give them our business? Or is it too limited in terms of the long-term effect that it could have? I often wonder about that. As an advertising person, I believe very much in frequency and repetition of a message. So does a one-time event just really, at the end of the day, have a benefit from a purely marketing standpoint? I don't have an answer to that. If you have one, I'm curious.
Yeah, there's an interesting effect. The reality is it would be hard to prove the effect that a single auction item would have from a business. And our hypothesis is the biggest impact as a business you will have is fairly immediately after that initial campaign. We can say, hey, there are 30 people that bid on this item. There are 50 people that clicked on it. We can measure a certain amount of interest that's fairly immediate. I think what's more exciting for businesses on our platform is kind of the ultimate network effect. And we'll just use golf courses as an example. So as our numbers continue to grow and at our current pace, within the next 2 years, we should be one of the largest, if not the largest platforms in the industry. So as our numbers continue to grow and the number of organizations doing campaigns on our platform grows, the number of consumers that will be participating in an online auction or something like that will also grow, exponentially. And so now a business is not just able to have visibility with the auction that they are explicitly supporting, but we're able to say, to donors who are already on our platform, what are the types of products or services that you are interested in hearing about within a certain radius of your home? And so whether that's, pipe cleaning or, let's again, using golf as an example, if you're a golfer, you might be interested in finding out any sort of deal, charity deal on a golf experience within 200 miles of your home. Now we can actually connect you to products that are and services and experiences run by another organization with something that actually interests you. And so that business is now getting a multiplicative effect in terms of exposure and visibility. And that becomes really exciting for them. And now you're able to make connections between that business and other nonprofits. And if we do our job well and are able to track the effectiveness of these campaigns, I think we will create an ecosystem where businesses will want to do more cause marketing because they'll be able to see the return on that. And consumers will find out and explore. We'll use our platform as a way of discovery for new products and services that actually go to help causes as well.
Is there a conflict? Well, when it comes to donor lists, organizations are very protective. If it allows them to identify another organization and now the organization connect with them, will they be revealing information they don't really want to reveal? Because my donor gives me now $100 a year and if he's supporting the other, then he only gave me $50 a year. Is there that concern about conflict and list?
Yeah, well, privacy and donor security is one of the things we take most seriously. Sharing information like that between organizations or to businesses or selling emails, something we'll never do. We think there are opportunities on our platform where we control the flow of information, to show opportunities to donors, without signing you up for 40 email lists. Just when you log into the next time you're participating on Better World, here are interesting things that are going on in your neighborhood. You're not being
an example. Let's say School A is doing a fundraising and they get the Better World opportunity list. I'll give it that name. And School B has arranged for free golfing or whatever if you donate to them. So now they're going to say, okay, I want to jump aboard School B because I'll have free golfing for a month. I mean, so they will somehow eventually end up connecting with School B, or am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. One, some of these things can be solved with privacy and permissions, where an organization can say, I want to be part of a broader network and experience the benefits of that network, or they can say, no, this is just for me. I don't want to be part of a larger network. That would be the first response. The second response is yes. I think as far as the amount somebody is willing to give in a year, there is a somewhat limited set amount of the dollars they're going to give to an organization. And organizations are right to be cagey over, you know, let's say the $100 that Colin's going to be able to give to charities this year, the $1,000, the $10, whatever that amount is. There's a certain percentage of that organizations might want to be protective of, as it were. But Colin is a donor 1% of the time, and he's a consumer 99% of the time. 1% of the time, he's giving to charity, but 99% of the time, he's looking to play golf. He's looking to go out to restaurants. He's looking to do things. I think there's a ton of open, a blue ocean of, there's a new pie that can be shared, not just the, you know, which percentage of Colin's charitable giving dollars are going to charity.
What percentage of major corporations, I assume not, but I may be wrong, participate in this form of charity donating, of NPO donating? You don't really get the major corporations. It's more local businesses, I assume, who are giving through this platform. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's far more local businesses, and I think that actually it speaks to the connectivity that a lot of community based organizations are going to want to help support these community driven kind of.
So if I am a national organization like Red Cross, this may not be, is this a good platform for me, or it's not the most effective platform for me?
Yeah, we've run organizations we've run campaigns with organizations like USA Cycling, for example, that does a national campaign to raise funds. But for an example like American Red Cross, they'll have a national office, but they'll have hundreds of local offices.
Right.
We shine with the national office for national campaigns, but we're also really great at the small local branches of that organization to come together to raise funds.
What percentage is individuals, someone in need? What percentage of your total amount of users are from individuals who are seeking funding?
Yeah, I would say it's a lower percentage. Our current focus has been on serving nonprofits and tools for nonprofits. We've opened up those tools to individuals who need to raise funds. So we have a number of crowdfunding campaigns. We have a number of individuals that are running auctions or giveaways. It hasn't been our focus, but we've had enough interest that we've accommodated those tools to enable individuals to use them. I think later this spring we'll look into it more as we.
And you mentioned crowdfunding, and I was thinking about this as you were talking. So if somebody said, "I got a great screenplay, and I want to do a film, and I need money and a half to do it," would you put that on the platform? Does that fit into your vision, mission, and so on?
Yeah. So our platform is entirely self-service. So they would be able to go on to Better World, set up their campaign, run it successfully, we'd be thrilled. We don't control, we moderate, certainly in some ways, but we don't control the organizations, the individuals that go on and raise.
Are you international? If I'm sitting in England or France, can I use your to raise locally, or?
We're domestic for now. We certainly have international on our horizon. It's something that we are exploring. But for now, we are just for organizations that are based in the U.S.
So now the classical question when I have two members of the same family, usually family is a double-edged sword. And part of the double-edged sword is a conflict, just a simple conflict of a role in the family within itself, of different visions. And typically it's primarily with generations. When you have a father handing it down to the son, the father wants to do it the old way, the son wants to move ahead progressively, and there's sparks fly. How do you find working together brother to brother, particularly does the younger brother always obey the older brother?
Well, it's good that you mentioned, I consider myself a father figure for Colin in many ways. And I jest. we have a ton of fun working together. I followed in my brother's footsteps in so many ways throughout my life, and it's been
I don't see a beard on you.
Yeah. I'm working on it. That's in the works.
Yeah, I mean, I think for it's truly like it's a dream being able to work with my brother. I mean, we have I think we have a lot of mutual respect for each other. We think very similarly. We share very similar values, and we have a lot of fun too. You know, and I think one thing that we have you know, as Whit mentioned, we've got a very small team. Our CTO is our third co-founder, And even as our team has started to grow, one of the first things we look for is a sense of humility, that we want smart, talented people that have big ambitions to do a lot of good. But there's just, you got to check your ego at the door. And so our meetings are great, where we're able to, everyone has a voice. Everyone's throwing out ideas. We've got a lot of good dialogue back and forth. But there's just very little conflict because we all have the same goals and
Let me switch the question around. Is the lack of conflict, the lack of yin and yang, problematic in the sense that seeing it from opposing view? And I want to broaden this picture. I once came across something fascinating, and it always stayed in my mind. According to Jewish law, I'm Jewish, according to the Bible, relatives who are not married, like a sister will not marry a brother, a cousin, you know, the immediate family. And it was explained because the purpose of marriage is for each one to raise themselves up on a higher level. And when people come from the same family, they tend to see things the same way. They don't see the flaw in the other one because that's the way they look at it. I always say to my interesting about the need to have an opposing viewpoint in order to really make sure you're doing it correctly, to make sure that you're growing in the right direction. So the fact that you both get along so well and you both come from the same instinct and upbringing and character, does that in some way, and I'm not sure you would even notice it, but do you think in some fashion that it limited that other idea from the outside that was said, well, but why don't we do this? Because, you know, I saw this, you know, and I come from a different culture and I come from a different background. And suddenly you see it from a very different way.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there may be areas that we're blind to that we don't know what we don't know. I think that there is generally positive conflict and positive kind of constructive conflict. You know, iron sharpens iron, and we very much believe that. And then there is kind of ego-driven conflict. And what we don't have is any of the ego-driven conflict. There are plenty of times where Whit and I will see something differently. And then, you know, give it a couple hours and he'll eventually come around to my point of view. But, no, we have a lot of healthy debate. And I think one thing that I've noticed about our team is we very much respect the kind of strengths and background of everyone on the team. And so Whit and I might have ideas about, kind of various technologies or what we might be able to do from a product point of view. But our CTO, Ben, he's one of the best in the country, you know, and so when it comes down to, what he believes about something, we're going to add a ton of weight to whatever he says there. And so we really have found it'll be interesting as we expand, because that's always the challenge as you grow. How do you maintain that? But for now, we really have a very good balance in my opinion. And especially
seeing this. Are you guys married? Because that's where you'll find that other viewpoint.
I am married. Whit is yet to be married.
Okay. So what keeps you up? It sounds like things are running smoothly. You definitely have room to grow. Is there anything that keeps you up nights? Or having a pretty good rest every night?
There's a long list. It all comes down to, I think, obsessing over the user experience. Our challenge is how do we take a demographic, the people that use our tools, we design for people that might not have a lot of experience with technology, might have never run an auction before. That's our target user. So, and we're working with the smartest 20 and 30 year old developers in the world. So continuing to obsess over what's intuitive to us that's not intuitive to other people. How do we make it so easy? How can we continue to refine what we're doing is the main, I guess, North Star that we're continuing to work and refine and be concerned about, which is a good problem to have. I mean, I think that's clearly the necessity for companies to keep improving in the right way.
Looking at both of you as entrepreneurs, on the bigger picture of entrepreneurship, what advice would both of you offer each individually to other entrepreneurs starting companies or running companies?
Yeah, I love that. I love that question, and it's my favorite question to ask older entrepreneurs. Because it's the question. And the way that I will generally ask it to older entrepreneurs is, what on the personal front? What personal elements of your life, or what have you learned on the personal side that has allowed you to be a better entrepreneur? Because that's where I didn't take that seriously starting out, the personal side of entrepreneurship, and I nearly burned out. So I would, if I were giving advice, I would say as much as you can, get a full night's rest, eat good food, get a workout in if you can, invest in relationships and friendships and all the things outside of work. If you're an entrepreneur, you have the drive to work hard and work long hours and obsess over your work. That needs to be balanced. And I know from personal experience that, that it can get out of balance with the
person. I share personal experience in that respect. Unfortunately, I lost my wife when I still had young children at home and I was raising them. And then originally I went to a grief group and it was a brilliant woman in charge and there were about 15 of the young man, unfortunately, widows and widows. And she kept saying that we have to take care of ourselves. And we sit there and say, take care of ourselves. We have to take care of the kids. We have our time to think about ourselves. And the one time it hit me what she was saying, if I don't take care of myself, I can't take care of the kids.
Yeah.
And I've got to learn to take care of myself. And I switched certain activities that I did during the day to give myself a breathing room.
Yeah.
And just recently, my daughter came to me and said, I look back and I'm so grateful for you doing that because it made such a difference in how you are and how the whole family was because you gave yourself time to breathe. So I understand, well, you need to be able to do that. Hmm. Colin, do you have any thoughts on this? What advice you would provide?
Yeah, I probably learned 1,000 lessons through 10,000 failures. I feel like there's some very practical ones. Always raise more money than you think you need. Be a lot slower on hiring team and pay up for the best talent you can possibly afford. And then I think to Witt's point on balance, have a clear sense of what you want, both for your business and for your life. I think without that, there can certainly be the tyranny of the urgent, that there will always be 1,000 things to do and you will have to prioritize. But you need to set some boundaries so that it can be sustainable and so that you can still have that passion to be able to pour into your business.
I just want to throw in one more thought, or question or thought, whatever. Better World is becoming a brand name or is already a brand name among your users. Is there an interest in creating the Better World family where all the participants across America in every type of a field, the endeavor that they're in, have an opportunity to share on their own experiences and information through a forum, through an online forum where.
I love it. It's a really great idea. It's a great idea and something that we've considered, but I think it's one of the next bounces of the ball of, we have all of these talented leaders, talented nonprofit leaders, talented business leaders. How could we share and give them a forum to share their experiences, their best practices? Not us marketing it at them, but them, but leaders sharing tips with other leaders. I think it's a really great idea.
Okay. One last question to you, Whit. When is the last time you lifted a tennis racket?
Oh, recently. Oh. I love it. Yeah. Okay. You play at all?
No. I'm a New York street boy, so there was no room for tennis. You had that basket hoop, and that's all you needed. Okay, great. This has been a wonderful, insightful, educational conversation. And I tip my hat to both of you for all the good that you're doing. I think it's really just tremendous. And both of you deserve great praise. And I'm very happy to have met you. I thank you for your time. Have a great year. Continued success.
Thank you for joining Charlie Katz, our executive extraordinaire, in yet another insightful interview. Be sure to check out more stories from CEOs across the country at bitbean.com/CEOs speak to learn more about what it takes to get to the top and stay there.